Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find Inforum online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and you can follow the best of our dialogue on Twitter with the hashtag InforumSF. I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW 91.7 FM, and tonight we are joined by Raj Patel, an activist and academic who's been hailed as a visionary for his commentary and analysis on the food crisis. Raj has worked for the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and has been tear gassed on four continents protesting those organizations. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food Crisis, and The Value of Nothing. And he's here to give us the inside story of the global food system and to also talk about international resistance movements working to make it democratic and sustainable. So let's get to it. So, Raj, you wrote the first version of your book in 2008, and at that time, 800 million people around the globe did not have enough to eat, and 1 billion people were overweight. So where are we today?
Well, sadly, things have gotten worse. Now we're in a world where there are around 1 billion people who are malnourished, and according to some estimates, nearly 2 billion people are overweight. So that's gotten a great deal worse in the five or so years since the original research for this book has been done. And that's been driven in large part by a couple of things. First of all, the recession. The recession is the vector through which poverty has increased. And the fact is we produce more food now per person than we ever have before in human history. There are more calories per person now than we've ever had. So the problem isn't a shortage of food. It's a shortage. It's an inability to be able to buy that food. If you want to see that, think about the United States. I mean, in the United States, 1 in 7 people is on what used to be called food stamps, SNAP entitlements. But no one would say in the United States that we have a shortage of food. You know, if we go into a supermarket, there's plenty of food. The reason that people don't get to eat in the United States is because of poverty. And that's the same reason the world over. So when poverty goes up, hunger goes up. But also this recession has been a moment of a consolidation for a range of corporations. Our banking system now is much more consolidated than it used to be in 2008. And our agriculture system has also become much more consolidated. The outcome of that is that the kinds of sugary, fatty, salty goods that our bodies are hardwired to crave are being pushed with ever more force by more powerful companies around the world. And so that's why you've got these sort of two trends accelerating of obesity and hunger at the same time.
Well, it's startling to think that we have 1 billion more people overweight in just 4 or 5 years.
It depends on how you look at the data. But it's certainly the case that the Western diet is spreading with rapidity through areas of the world that are sort of catching up to North America and Europe. So you're seeing epidemic levels of diabetes, for example, in India. And India and China now have, in the epidemiological literature, a kind of death race where each is trying to outcompete each other in the number of diabetes cases they have. But at the moment we have, I mean, India, according to the latest data, is home to the world's largest number of people with type 2 diabetes. And that's really a function of this sort of shift towards the Western diet. And it's largely an urban problem. I mean, if you look in rural India, diabetes incidence is about 3%, but in the cities it's around 15%. In a country of 1 billion people, that's a health crisis that's only going to get worse.
I was just in Costa Rica and was sort of surprised to see almost every fast food place we have here, there, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Taco Bell. I even saw Walmart in San Jose, Costa Rica, which just opened. And I asked the taxi driver if he shops there, and he says he doesn't because it's too expensive.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that Walmart is the world's largest retailer, the world's largest grocer, and certainly in the United States, it's the place that most Americans go to, you know, to get their food, or more than any other place. But Walmart does have a strategy, usually, of going into a country, undercutting local retailers and then bumping up the prices. But, I mean, if they haven't quite established themselves in Costa Rica, they've certainly done that in other parts of the world. In Mexico, for example, Walmex is the largest food retailer there. $1 in $5 that's spent on food in a supermarket is spent in a Walmart in Mexico. And that, you know, that is an indication of the control they have of the food market there.
What did you think of Michelle Obama's relationship when she announced that she was teaming up with Walmart when she got on stage with the executives to say she was working with them on their healthy food campaign?
That was awkward. because, here you have someone who is, you know, clearly very passionate about exercise and making sure that her kids eat well, about this, you know, this organic garden in the White House. But for every organic garden, it was very interesting that the organic garden in the White House was announced, and then the Pesticide Association of America, or whatever their sort of cleaned up name is, you know, Chemicals for a Better You, whatever they call themselves, they announced that no pesticides are part of a healthy, nutritious diet, and in part they were able to get a position on the on an advisory committee at the USDA. In exchange for the announcement of the White House garden. So when Michelle Obama says, well, you know, Walmart is going to be the vector, the mechanism through which poor people get access to organic food, I sort of had to hold my head in my hands. Because the problem in areas that don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables isn't that they don't have a discount retailer that pays cripplingly low wages and treats its workers very badly in their neighborhood. That's not the reason why people don't have fresh fruits and vegetables. And we find ourselves sort of in this weird dichotomy where if you hear a lot about this idea of food deserts, right? This idea that there are parts of the country where it is hard to get good fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, it's certainly true that there are parts of the country where it's hard to get fresh fruits and vegetables, but it's not like these areas are barren of food. There's plenty of food. There's plenty of spending on food happening in these economies. And so it's not a desert. It's an area where it is hard to get fresh fruits and vegetables. Now, you have to ask yourself, well, why is it hard? It's because the infrastructure for providing fresh fruits and vegetables isn't there. It's because fresh fruits and vegetables are not subsidized as much as our commodity crops are in the farm bill. It's because people are poor. Now, you don't fix those problems by dropping a Walmart there. And that's why, you know, it was toe-curling to see, you know, the First Lady and Walmart up on stage together, because it seemed to me nothing more than a sort of a political gambit on the part of the White House that by having this, you know, these unlikely bedfellows, that at least maybe the Waltons would stop giving all their money away to the Republican PACs and the Super PAC, which hasn't happened. So, I mean, I think that there are important ways in which we can fight the inability of poor people to be able to access fresh fruits and vegetables. I don't think making people poorer by giving them jobs at Walmart is the answer.
And I followed the media coverage of that, and there wasn't that much analysis of the relationship. Can you seriously take on this issue without using the word subsidy?
I think that the word subsidy itself is one of these sort of poisonous words, particularly at a time where any kind of government spending is considered profligate, and the way that politically we have tackled this recession has been to think, well, obviously we need cuts, and we need, you know, subsidies are just fat that our government really oughtn't to be spending, and so subsidies are just wasteful. The trouble is, of course, you know, education is a subsidy. Transport and infrastructure is a subsidy. If we understand that actually subsidies don't need to be bad, if we think of them as support, if we think of them as investment in our common future, then the word subsidy loses some of its venom. But we need the political work to make that acceptable. So I think it's very hard to have this conversation without talking about what it is that together we want and that we want to spend on. Particularly when the word subsidy has become toxic, it is hard to have that conversation.
And what do you think we need to know about subsidies and why you have such cheap junk food and organic broccoli. I just went to the store. I think it was two something a pound.
Well, I mean, there's a long history of the way that agribusiness has become this sort of succubus on our public purse. But certainly right now, as the farm bill is being negotiated, if you look at the way government operates in general, we're finding that the largest lobbies are able to secure for themselves some of the richest benefits. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, even when it comes to things like food stamps, for example, it didn't always used to be the case that food stamps could be spent on junk food. That's a much more recent phenomenon. And it is possible for us to reverse some of these ideas, reverse some of these sort of freebies to the food industry. But it does mean that we need much more transparency around where our subsidies go. For example, in the food system, we don't actually know who benefits from the food stamps or the SNAP entitlements. There was a report that came out today that shows that actually the U.S. Department of Agriculture isn't disclosing who it is that our federal money goes to. And, you know, as the farm bill is being drafted, you know, this $1 trillion over 10 years farm bill, that's a lot of money. And the largest part of that farm bill is around food stamps. And we don't even know who's in receipt of those. And the weird thing is, I mean, I can go to the Pentagon website and, you know, go to defense.gov/contracts and see where the money's going. But I can find out who's bombing our enemies, but I can't see who's feeding our children. The USDA is hiding that information. I think if we are to understand who is suckling away at the public teat, we need much more transparency than we have at the moment.
And the Farm Bill is being debated right now in the Senate.
That's right.
So if people want to raise their voices, now is a good time to do it.
It is. And soon it'll move into the House where there'll be much more sort of partisanship and where, sadly, we'll see a particular targeting of the food stamp program, of SNAPs, of the SNAP entitlement. And, you know, you'll have this debate, really, about between the Republicans and the Democrats around whether hungry people, and many of whom are children, deserve to be fed or not. And I think that's a horrific discussion to be having in what is still one of the richest countries on earth.
You write in your book that in a global economy, one government's actions on the international market have consequences for everyone else. What struck me really about your book is that things are so globalized now, and you've got five countries on one page, just talking about how everything is so connected. So how do U.S. policies affect the global food system? How will this farm bill, for example, affect farmers and growers in, say, Haiti and India, for example?
Well, it depends on the commodity. It depends on the crop. But there are so many ways in which our trade policy has already had massive effects globally. I mean, one of the reasons why we had the 2008 food price crisis, which I think everyone remembers that in 2008 the price of pretty much everything, but certainly fuel and then food, went up. One of the drivers of that was a policy here around biofuels. Biofuels is the idea that we need to be growing corn in order to turn it into ethanol in order to be able to burn it. That's a policy that makes very little sense in terms of climate change, because you end up using much more carbon producing this ethanol than you do by just burning diesel. So in terms of environmental reasons, it doesn't make any sense. But it's renewable. Corn sort of comes out of the ground season after season. And there's something sort of green and happy and kind of groovy about that. But the trouble is that renewable is not the same as sustainable. Renewable, yes, it comes year after year, but it's not sustainable. It requires much more energy and much more in terms of resources to put into it to turn it into ethanol. Sadly, that was a policy that made a lot of sense in 2008 because it was an election year. And in 2008, no one wanted to come out against the corn producers. And so it was decided in 2008 that it was better to burn American corn than it was to burn Saudi oil. But that's not a good reason to have this policy. But the trouble is that having this policy meant a lot of switching of farmers to growing ethanol for corn. It meant that the price of other products went up. There was speculation in the price of corn, and the price of corn itself went up because now there was this new market of American gas tanks. And that had ripple effects around the world. The World Bank estimated that it was upward of 50% of the global food price crisis could be attributed to this just this one policy. Now, I think that's an overestimate. But it's certainly, you know, I think it's fair to say that 15% of the reason of why people went hungry in 2008 was because we decided we want to burn corn.
Well, and also you write that the system itself was really engineered to create a world of increasing hunger and obesity. So talk a little bit about the market forces involved that keep things so out of balance. So we see these numbers just continuing to increase.
Well, I mean, the way we distribute food at the moment is through the market. And if you distribute food through the market, you have two rules. One, the first rule is if you have money, you get to eat. And if you have as much money as we do, you get to have food from, you know, brought from anywhere around the world. Of course, even there's a sort of a divide, because we've seen in the United States that it's only the relatively wealthy who are able to eat a rich and balanced diet. For the majority of people working, you know, running from one job to another, cheap food is the way that you survive on, you know, relatively low wages. Nonetheless, we have food here. But the flip side of distributing food through the market is if you don't have money, then you starve. And that's pretty, you know, by handing over the distribution of food to the market, that's the rules, you know, those are the rules of the game. And that's why you can have, you know, increased levels of poverty leading to increased starvation, even at the same time as we're producing more food than ever before.
And also talk a little bit about Wall Street and how Wall Street affects the food system. I always like to talk about history, and in this country that means going back to the year 2000. So you write about the Commodity Futures Modernization Act signed by Bill Clinton, which opened up a wild west of financial enterprise in which billions were staked on anything that could be turned into a commodity, and that included bets on the price of food.
Yes, I mean, the history of this might have to go back just a little bit more into the 1990s. Cast your mind back. imagine, you know, it was before the internet, before gravity. In the 1990s, Goldman Sachs came up with what was called the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and the journalist Fred Kaufman has a wonderful set of articles about this and a book coming out about it I very much recommend. Through the 1990s, Goldman Sachs realized that they could you could have an index in the same way that you have, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial or the Financial Times 100, a set of key commodities that would not only an index that you could not only track but invest in. And just in the same way as if you want a secure investment, you invest in, you know, the blue chip stocks in the, you know, in the top 100. Goldman Sachs was creating a financial product that you could invest in. This involved mainly energy, but also corn, hogs, a range of agricultural products too. And they were able to secure an exemption from the Commodity Trading Futures Commission for laws that have been there really since the Great Depression to stop financial entities from speculating on food. Well, you know, in the early 1990s, Goldman Sachs won a small exemption that was made into this very big generalized exemption under Bill Clinton in 2000 that basically stopped the regulation of over-the-counter trades in these commodities. And that meant that all of a sudden there was a lot of money that was chasing after it, you know, a great return. We had the bubble in 2008 and the housing bubble burst, and then we sort of bubble in oil and that bubble burst. And so investors moved their money to food. One of the reasons why, and this is hotly debated, but it's certainly not debated that one of the reasons why we have increased price swings in the food system now is because financiers are betting on the price of food. And when prices go up and down, that's a great environment in which, if you have a little bit of information or a little bit of savvy about where those prices are going, you can make a ton of cash. But it doesn't seem to be helping farmers any. It doesn't seem to be helping consumers any. What it has done is make a few people on Wall Street and in other parts of the world very, very rich indeed. And I think that this is, it's worth us paying attention to this, because when I was writing Stuffed and Starved, it's true that, the giants of the food system are people like, you know, Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and Bunge and Monsanto and Walmart. But they also include, I write about this a little more, one of the reasons I did this update in this revision, it also includes Goldman Sachs. It includes corporations like Glencore, and the Noble Group. And these are sort of mysterious companies that Glencore, though, controls 25% of the global barley market. And they just did a deal where they managed to reap the rewards of a privatization of the wheat board in Canada. They control a quarter of the shipping facilities for grain to go from Western Canada to Asia. And these are corporations that are incredibly powerful, but lurk in the background, but have made a great deal of money through the liberalization of the financial industry.
And we didn't get any regulation on these companies in the last 4 years?
Painfully little. And of course, these corporations are largely mobile. So now, one of the hubs of these kinds of trades is Singapore. Although, yes, of course, that there are U.S. laws that these companies must comply with, it is a Wild West at the moment. The very slight amount that we've been able to wring from our government officials in terms of reining in the banking industry really is very little compared to even what we had in the 1930s.
How can you paint us a picture how to make sense of this? Because it is so big. And here in the Bay Area, we're so lucky to have farmers markets. And we have such a great food justice movement here. And we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But again, when I'm reading your book, so many visuals came up, going from country to country, and Indian suicides in India, and then farmer suicides in South Korea. When you talk about the global food movement, how do you make sense of it in a tangible way?
Well, I mean, the picture that I use in the book that's good for radio, but is an hourglass. So imagine something that's wide. An hourglass, people, come on. This is the young in forum Commonwealth thing. But before we had an hourglass, like in The Wizard of Oz. Cast your minds back. So wide at the top, narrow in the middle, and wide at the bottom. Wide at the top are the millions of farm workers around the world who work for the millions of farmers who produce the food that we eat every day if we can. And down the bottom, the 7 billion of us now who try to eat. But in the middle, it's very narrow. We have millions of farmers, billions of consumers, and just a handful of corporations that are running the show. In every major agricultural market, it's 5 or 6 corporations that control more than half the global market. So it's pinched in the middle. And having that in mind, understanding that concentration of power helps understand the different places that people are fighting the fight in the food system. People are obviously fighting in the Bay Area. We're very lucky to have people concerned about consumption, concerned about how we eat, concerned about CSAs and about farmers markets. But it's also, we also have people who are fighting to make sure that people who can't afford to go to farmers markets are able to access fresh fruits and vegetables. Understanding that fight at the bottom of the food system, I think, is important. But also understanding the fight at the top. Farm workers are a largely forgotten constituency. When we think about eating local and going to the local farmers market, we can sort of be overcome by a wave of just self-righteousness. Where it's like, well, I have painted myself green by buying this sacred kale. And of course, often forgotten is the fact that's the product of someone's work. And here in California, that's usually a person of color. And usually someone who's paid very badly. And it's important to bear in mind up and down the food system, actually, that people are paid incredibly badly. There was a report that came out just last week that showed that 86% of people working in the food system, in warehousing, in retail, in food service, are unable to pay, don't get a living wage. So they're not able to eat properly. They're on the poverty line.
Yeah, I wonder if people realize that the farmers in the Central Valley who pick our food cannot afford to eat the food they pick. We did a show about the food banks in the Central Valley that are just overwhelmed with demand. So can you talk a little bit about that? And I've also read that a lot of the women farm workers in the Monterey area have bandanas over their faces so people can't see their gender because they're often sexually harassed, assaulted.
It's an awful, awful situation that our food system, but of course our food system is designed to work well that way, right? I mean, when you have this hourglass, right, and the bottleneck at the middle, the corporations that profit from the food system operate like all corporations must. They buy cheap and they sell dear. So they buy cheap. That means driving down the prices of these their raw materials. That means getting government support. That means getting their snouts in the trough. But it also means paying people very little. That's how you reduce costs. You drive down wages. That's why California. That's why the food system in general exploits workers, because that's how profits are made. And similarly, the reason that when you sell deer, selling processed food is much more lucrative than selling fresh fruits and vegetables. That's why there's much more money in selling foods that are obesogenic than it is than there are selling kale. But the fight of farm workers is one that also has a very long history in this state. One could go back to the United Farm Workers. One could go back to Steinbeck. And see conditions actually in the fields that Steinbeck wrote about that are still very much around today.
Right. In fact, they were fighting for shade and bathroom breaks just about 5 or 6 months ago. Are the farm workers treated better on organic farms?
It depends. I mean, we heard a couple of years back a story of a farm worker who was working on a large-scale organic farm who died because she was denied water. And so she died of heat exposure. So there's nothing automatic about eating organically that confers virtue, at least as far as farm workers are concerned. The way that one ensures that is through unionizing, there are at the moment domestic fair trade initiatives that I think are interesting. But of course, fair trade is important, and this is a sort of line I use all the time, which is that look, I buy fair trade coffee, for example. I mean, it's important to buy fair trade coffee because what's the alternative? Blood on your beans coffee, the sort of coffee that involves the exploitation of children. No one wants that. But isn't it weird then that we have the option to buy that? It's either fair trade or you could have blood on your beans. We won't advertise a blood on your beans coffee. We don't want to offend your sensibilities. But actually, that's exactly what it is. Why is it that we allow the exploitation of workers in the way that we do and make it an option just to pay a little bit more to opt out of that? Surely we need legislation to actually raise those wages. And there are groups that are campaigning for that. You have the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, you have the United Farm Workers. And I think that supporting them is definitely an important thing to do.
And also, does it help when you go to the farmer's market to ask your friendly farmer farm workers are treated and express interest and say that you actually care about this issue?
I think that's vital.
Yeah. And what about organic? Because there are so many now, we call them food celebrities, I guess, but there's this huge food movement, people writing books about food. It's no longer just the Michael Pollans of the world. You've got so many other ones. Jamie Oliver, I believe, he was just in California recently. What are your thoughts about, everybody has an opinion about why we should eat organic. What are your thoughts on
well,
that?
Well, I mean, there are two celebrity chefs I have in my sights, but I mean, because Anthony Bourdain is presents himself as a sort of lad of the kitchen, right? And he has cast aspersions on Alice Waters and on Californians in general for our our interest in organic food and sort of fit ideas about what things should look like, but. What I like about him is that he treats his work as well, and he thinks that that's an important thing to do, right? He stands up for workers' rights, and he doesn't like it when other celebrity chefs shout out the workers in their kitchen and treat them badly, because they are, he understands the dedication and the sort of spine it takes to be working for minimum wage under appalling conditions, and the kind of character it takes to be able to do that day in, day out for years. So he has a sort of laddish, friendly chumminess with people who work for him in the boundaries of his kitchen. But organic is a workers' rights issue. If you care about the people who work for you and who are involved in the production of this food, then you have to, you have to eat organic. Because certainly we're seeing rates, the data around pesticide exposure in California show a wide range of public health effects that are associated, ranging everything from birth defects to increased levels of autism and what have you, as a result of being exposed or being in communities where pesticide exposure is much higher. And so it seems to me just hugely contradictory for someone to sort of, in a very laddish, as I say, a laddish way, say, well, I think people who work for me and people who work in the food service industry, have have incredible fortitude, and at the same time castigate consumers for wanting to care about workers in the field. Because when you buy organic, you're really caring about the people who grow your food and trying to stop them being exposed to the kinds of toxins that not only shorten their lives, but the lives of their children too. But when it comes to Jamie Oliver, I think Jamie Oliver's a bit of a hero. Because in Britain, he took on this idea of making sure that kids eat well. And he identified exactly what it was in Britain. Because he saw that really what it was a labor issue. The women, and it's overwhelmingly women, who cook food in schools are underpaid, or were underpaid in Britain. And he launched a campaign that was directly targeted at raising the wages of dinner ladies, as they are called in Britain. And because he got very political very early on, he was able to make that transformation and make it a national priority. And he succeeded in Britain. It was amazing. But the moment he came over here, he wasn't allowed to talk about politics. He wasn't allowed to raise any of these issues around the USDA or about the low-paid workers in schools. And also he was fighting against a pretty tough, a different culture. I mean, there was an experiment that he did that I thought was very interesting. He did it in Britain and in the US. And you won't know this unless you'd seen both versions. But, he brought kids in and he's like, kids, we're going to deconstruct, or he didn't use deconstruct, we're going to show you how you make chicken McNuggets or turkey Twizzlers in Britain, they're called. Turkey Twizzlers. the sort of staple. You take this bird and he's like, right, well, we get rid of the feathers and now we're going to put in the eyeballs and the nads and, the various bits and pieces. We're going to turn it into this pink foam and, kids on both sides of the Atlantic. Oh, God, that's horrible, that's horrible. We're going to whiz it round in this food processor and then you have this sort of pink foam. And now we're going to deep fry it. And he takes it out. It's like, right, kids in Britain, would you like to, would you like to eat this? And the kids in Britain are like, oh, God, no, oh, that's horrible. And in the US, it's like, right, kids in America, would you like to eat this? And the kids are like, yeah, all right. I think that also sort of betrays the extent to which we have been seduced by the deep frying industry. But also the extent to which we're actually quite divorced from our food in this country in a way that very few countries are. And I think to be able to do that sort of mental acrobatics, to be able to distance oneself from the horrors one has just seen, I think betrays how very far we have to go in reconnecting with our food system.
He also does the experiment where he asks kids, what this is, a tomato or just different vegetables, and they don't in the U.S.
Yeah.
A lot of them don't. What can we do about that? I mean, there are so many great programs happening. What do you see happening on the ground that we might not be hearing about in terms of educating people about where our food comes from?
Well, I mean, I think, luckily, again, being in the Bay Area, we're very fortunate to have things like the Edible Schoolyard Initiative started by Alice Waters and the Shea Panisse Foundation that spreads a lot of these ideas and teaches kids fairly early on about how where food comes from by encouraging them to grow it. And that, I think, is very exciting. And not only to grow the food, but then to cook it, and then to sit round and eat it together. And I think that art of socializing over the table is also a lost art. And it was really exciting to be at one of these edible schoolyards. I mean, there's an edible schoolyard at the Boys and Girls Club in Hunters Point. And it's an amazing experience because you have these kids who are, who are growing the food in these containers. Obviously, it's a Superfund site, so you don't grow it in the ground, but you grow it in these containers. They're in an incredibly deprived neighborhood, but they're super excited about doing this, about cooking it, and then sitting around the table, and there are these sort of starter cards for conversation, because actually learning how to have a conversation over a dinner table is something you learn. And if you haven't been exposed to that at home because your parents are working however many jobs, then, of course, you need a little nudge. And so these fantastic cards about, what do you want to be when you grow up? Or why is there racism in the world? Dinner table conversation. And it's fantastic. And it means all of a sudden you're not only embracing the joy of eating, but the joy of conversing, and you're talking about politics. And I think that's wonderful. I think politics and food go together very well.
What else is exciting you right now in terms of food activism. What are we not hearing about? Because you often hear the negative. That's very easy to talk about in the media. We tend to focus more on that and not so much the, I don't want to say good news, but there's some amazing activism happening around the globe. Talk about what's happening in the Bay Area, and then I'll ask you about your recent trip to Japan.
In the East Bay, you have an amazing array of organizations. You have the Oakland Food Policy Council, for example, that brings together the municipality. So it brings the city, the school district, and the school district is very excitingly moving towards increasing the amount of local sustainable food in the food that it gives to children there. You're seeing young people being trained in living wage jobs in the food industry, and that comes through everything from city slicker farms to fat beets to the People's Grocery is running a think tank around, throwing out all kinds of ideas about ways in which we can build a sustainable food economy in the Bay Area. And I'm really excited by each of whether it's an incentive, whether a movement to make sure that Meals on Wheels programs become more sustainable, or figuring out language so that universities can embrace a sort of 20% purchasing from within the state policy, which is something that is a win-win, right? It supports public universities within states are state institutions, and so wouldn't it be good if we purchased from stimulated the state economy by making sure that local sustainable farmers have access to this fantastic market? These ideas are sort of popping up all over the place. And what's really exciting is that they're getting joined together. So it's not just one idea here and one idea there and one idea there, but things like food policy councils, and in fact there's now a California Food Policy Council, which is a new invention, but something that's designed precisely to be able to connect up the dots so that we have a much more resilient and robust food system.
It seems like there's so much more awareness about these issues, and people are tired of being sold these boxes of, fiber and pills in a box, basically. And I love Michael Pollan actually talked about how the food industry at one point realized, if you all just buy carrots and lettuce and tomatoes, they're not really going to make much money from you. So they need to put all this stuff in a box along with other chemicals and natural flavoring. Does anyone know what that is? Natural flavoring, right, right. It's in so many things, right? It is. And people don't know what it is. But it seems like there's so much more awareness right now, and there's a ripe time for something. Do you see something?
No, I do.
Changing?
I mean, I certainly think when I came to the Bay Area in 2002, obviously there was a long legacy of the food movement being here, things like Food First, and even the Black Panthers and their food program that was feeding more kids than the state of California was in the early 1970s. People forget that the Black Panthers were in fact also concerned about food and hunger and nutrition as well. But it's been really interesting just in those, in these 10 years to see the explosion of the food movement, not just in the Bay Area, but within the United States as well. So I do think that there's a lot of energy, but I also think that the food movement is fighting back. One need only look to New York City, for example, and the sort of outcry from the food industry there around Mayor Bloomberg's sort of cap at whatever it is, 16 ounces for you are no longer, or his proposal is that you no longer be allowed to buy a quantity of soda as large as your head, but instead be limited to something you can possibly hold in your hand, and certainly when it comes to even here, right here in San Francisco, when we passed the law that said that you couldn't have toys with Happy Meals, the food industry was way out in front of that, and they were like portraying advocates of that policy, of whom I was one, as murderers of fun. I think it's important to flip this argument on its head. We're told that if you're banning toys with Happy Meals, or you're cutting off portion sizes above 16 ounces, that you're in some way trying to limit the freedom of consumers. But you're not. You're actually increasing the freedom of parents. You're increasing the freedom to be able to make an informed choice, and to not have your kid go into a particular place and say, no, I want the one that looks like it's the size of a basketball. But instead, to be able to... we're often told that it's parents' responsibility to make sure the kids eat well. Then give me half a chance. And bills like you know, taking the toys out of Happy Meals, stop the pester factor that drive parents reluctantly to these fast food places. Removing the top tier of a choice of three things means that you're more likely to choose something much smaller and much better for you. Now, of course, if you want to drink something the size of your head, you're more than welcome to just keep refilling and keep buying. So there's not that infringement on liberty. What there is, though, is more freedom for a parent to help their kids make the right decision. And that liberty is something that the food industry hasn't been able to push back on. So I do feel like there's much more of a sense that actually people want that freedom, freedom from corporations rather than freedom to become, to be able to give money to corporations.
And how has this journey changed the way you eat and your food habits?
Well, I mean, I like eating food that I grow, and I'm actually much more sensitive to the way things taste now than I used to be. I have become a foodie. And that's actually a good thing. I mean, obviously, you hear this sort of term foodie tossed around like it's a sort of pejorative. But actually to care about sensuality and to care about joy and pleasure, that's something that the food industry kind of took away from me. I mean, I grew up in a convenience store where, we sold bags of crisps and crisps of proper pronunciation, of course, and candy and, sugary snacks and all the rest of it. And so actually eating healthy, wonderful tomatoes, again, correct pronunciation, and a range of other, sort of glorious foods has actually been a revelation. And I've been able to do that by connecting with the food movement. I think that's been very, very exciting. And so while, again, the food industry would have me represent me as a sort of turncoat and as a goad and a scold, encouraging people to give up the sweet, the confections of the food industry, actually what I'm encouraging people to do is embrace joy. Who doesn't like pleasure?
I also wanted to briefly to have you talk about the Green Revolution and efforts to dismantle that. And, of course, the Green Revolution was based on the idea that science will save the world. What is happening around the globe to dismantle this?
Well, it's not about dismantling. I mean, the Green Revolution was this idea that was sold really through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, that it was possible to use science to produce a lot of food. But that wasn't the real thrust of the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution was presented as an alternative to the Red Revolution of the Soviets and the White Revolution of the Shah of Iran. This was the language used when we were told about the Green Revolution. And the idea was this, that the Green Revolution was going to be the alternative way to stop, to keep poor people happy and fed. So instead of poor people getting angry with their governments and going communist, or overthrowing their governments as they did in Iran, the U.S. would fund a green revolution, a revolution that would encourage more food in the fields to go really to urban consumers who would then eat and not riot. And that logic is still around today. I mean, if you look at the Arab Spring that began with a spike in the price of wheat in 2011, the spike in the price of wheat was the sort of, it was a spark that lit the Arab Spring. But the thinking that, well, if we provide cheap food produced, mass-produced, industrially agriculturally produced food, and make that food cheap, then people will stop rioting. Well, that logic was the logic used by President Ben Ali from Tunisia. The last thing he did before he fled Tunisia for Malta was to drop the price of bread by 50%. Because he thought, well, in order to stop people rioting, we need cheap food. And that's the logic of the Green Revolution. Cheap food means a pliant population. That's that's the idea of the Green Revolution. And the Green Revolution isn't green in the sense of environmentally sustainable. It's just green in terms of, the leaves on the plant and the amount of money that's needed to subsidize it, because it takes a great deal of money to increase, to create the incentives that create these surplus commodities. That's why the Farm Bill is also, in a way, part of the Green Revolution. Sadly, that's still carrying on. Groups like Monsanto, for example, are now saying, well, what we need to do is genetically engineer crops so that they are now ready for the next green revolution of being ready for climate change. The trouble is that when you look at their drought guard crops, as they are called, those crops don't do any better than conventionally bred crops. And they do much worse when you think about, these crops are engineered for ideal conditions, for just a little drought. But climate change isn't about just a little anything. climate change is about, you know, turning it up to 11, whatever that is, whether it's in terms of pests, in terms of heat, in terms of rain at the wrong time, in terms of drought. Climate change is about increasing extreme weather events. And yet, you know, our policymakers are still hammering away at the policies that worked in the 20th century. What we need is an agriculture for the 21st century. And again, around the world, you are seeing much more of that. But it's going to take a lot to shake sense into our policymakers.
Well, we're going to take your questions in just a couple minutes. You can start lining up at the two microphones. And remember that we're looking for one short and pithy question. There's a mic there, and there's a mic there. I wanted you to also talk about the new project you're working on called Generation Food. And I understand you recently got back from Japan.
Right. So we're talking a lot about how bad everything is. And it's not that it's bad to have books like Stuffed and Starved. But I'm tired of hearing about what's broken with the food system, and I'm tired of writing books about what's wrong with the food system. I'm actually very interested in writing and researching what we can do to fix things. And what I'm also keen to do is to get that out to as many people as possible. So while books are important, and you know, praise be to the Commonwealth Club and for y'all for being readers, sadly, not as many people as one might hope are readers. And so one of the things we're doing is not only writing a book, but working on a film. I'm really excited to be working with a director whose name is Steve James. He did films like Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters, which are fabulous movies that are really about, you know, sort of social change, social justice, and transformation, really about solutions in an important way. So we're working on this international project, looking at how one generation is feeding another, as a way of showing some really innovative ideas about how we're going to feed the world and feed the world across generations. So I just got back from Japan, where Japan is home to a tragedy at the moment. I mean, obviously there's Fukushima and the half-life of 30 years that cesium is, right? I mean, you have grandparents who are eating the food that they grow locally, but they don't give that to their grandkids because it's radioactive. Mm. So the kids are eating imported food, and the grandparents are eating, you know, food that they grow themselves. And what the grandparents want, but one of them told me, is this 12th generation farmer said, what we really want is for grandparents and grandkids to eat from the same pot. Mm. And sadly, that won't happen for another 30 years. And so instead, what you have is young people really going after the knowledge of their grandparents and trying to learn from them as deeply as they can and trying to preserve those food traditions in some really exciting ways by bringing people together, by figuring out ways of exchanging safe food.
They'll have to import for 30 years?
Well, at least, because cesium has a half-life of 30 years. And that's... So in the affected areas, they're going to have to import food from outside those areas. But what they are doing is preserving the knowledge. And they're figuring out some really exciting ways of doing that, involving some really quite good food. Mm. I think, again, what they've managed to do is bring people together to share in the joy of that food and to share in the exchange over generations that I think we've lost in our food system.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum, Connect Your Intellect, and tonight we're hosting Stuffed and Starved Still with Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, and I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW 91.7 FM. And now let's go to audience questions.
Hi. With more on climate change, you know, there was a report a couple of weeks ago that greenhouse gases globally are still increasing despite all these efforts, so mitigation is kind of failing at this point. Should farmers be looking to adapt, or would that even be enough? Are we going to hit tipping points? How do you look at the future, considering how dire things are at the moment?
That's a great question. Thank you. I mean, you're right that there are some efforts to mitigate and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but not much. We're still geared towards an economy that's premised on fossil fuels. And as long as we continue on this path, the future is going to look very dire indeed. Certainly it seems to me that farmers need to adapt, but luckily it's not up to me. The farmers are already doing it. One of the cases we'll be looking at in Generation Food is in Malawi, where farmers are already finding that the climate is doing some very strange things. That the corn that they used to be planting just wasn't working very well. And so they've discovered new ways of farming that involve polyculture, that involve farming with crops that fix nitrogen in the soil, that attract beneficial insects, that shade their crops. They find that, for example, in climate change in Malawi, because of climate change in Malawi, it gets so hot that plants stop photosynthesizing. And so what they find is if when you increase shade cover by 30%, you increase yields by 30%. So shade is actually the friend of climate-friendly agriculture. And they're discovering all these ways of farming, and they're already doing it. And so I think absolutely we need to be moving towards a more sustainable and adapted kind of climate change-friendly agriculture. And that means giving up on the fossil fuels that we require for industrial agriculture. One of the other reasons in 2008 that the food prices went up was because oil prices went up, and oil and natural gas is the key ingredient in fertilizer. I mean, this is why we have fertilizer bombs, right, is because they are incredibly energy dense. So I absolutely think we need to move away from the kinds of industrial agriculture we have at the moment, and farmers around the world are really interested in doing it. I think this has been the other change over the past 10 years, working with international peasant groups like La Via Campesina. In 2002, maybe 5% of Via Campesina was interested in sustainable agroecological food systems. Now 95% of these peasant farmers are really interested in figuring out how this happens because they're already seeing the effects of climate change in their fields.
I just want to say thank you so much for your hard work and your activism in such an important issue. Could you please speak about the genetically modified practice? I and many other people are concerned about it, and I've read that there are countries that don't want to import all these genetically modified things. Plus, normally we label very well in this country, but these things aren't labeled. And the little I've read about it is, it sounds really negative. I also think it's unethical because they're mixing species. You think you're eating a vegetable, and they've sliced genes in from a fish or an animal.
Right.
And I read some years back that new strains of viruses and bacteria can be very harmful and
this
hurt
is
people.
These issues will actually get a lot of attention in California because we're going to vote on the labeling law in November, and all states are watching us.
Right.
And they're pouring all the money into this campaign. So what would you say about GMOs?
Well, I mean, I certainly think we take that GMO labeling law right off the bat, we need to be absolutely voting in support of the transparency. Even if you don't think you care about GMOs, surely you would care to know whether you're eating them or not. I think the labeling law is something that we absolutely need in this state, and expect to see all kinds of misrepresentations from the industry as that law, as our opportunity to vote on that comes. So who is it that will be telling tales about the GMO law? Well, it'll be the pesticide industry, because genetically modified crops are pretty much crops that are engineered either to withstand a pesticide or to exude a pesticide from its leaves, from a plant's leaf. So genetically modified crops are either tolerant to a herbicide called Roundup. And so what farmers do, well, they'll plant one thing, and then rather than worry about the weeds, they'll just fly over and spray with this hormone-based pesticide that will, sorry, herbicide that will kill everything except the one plant that you're growing. Or they will grow a crop that will exude small quantities of this pesticide from its leaves. The trouble is that these crops are already being outsmarted by nature. We're seeing super weeds that are resistant, for example, to Roundup, to the extent that now Dow Chemical is applying for a patent to make a new generation of crops resistant to a new kind of pesticide. And that pesticide was one of the key ingredients in Agent Orange.
Mm.
So, in other words, genetically modified crops were sold to us as, well, this we'll have to use less pesticides and we'll be smart about our agriculture. And now we're reduced because of these, the life cycle of this monoculture and this spraying has ended. Now we're back to, well, all right, well, a little Agent Orange won't hurt. And I think that's another reason to be moving away from this kind of agriculture. I think it's tremendously dangerous. So I absolutely think that maybe the biggest argument against GM crops is we don't need them. We are able, through farming systems that, don't take my word for it, take an international panel of scientists who released a report a couple of years back, an international study of agriculture and how we will feed the world by 2050. And they came up with the idea that actually what we need is more urban and peri-urban farms, we need more agroecology, we need more polyculture, growing different things together, and genetically modified crops have done very badly given the amount of money we've thrown at them over the past few years. We need to be looking elsewhere for a food system that's going to feed the world.
Thank you. There's a great documentary called The World According to Monsanto.
Monsanto, that's a fantastic
and you can
film.
Watch it for free online. Really amazing.
Yeah, that's
film.
Eye-opening.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could compare and contrast a plant-based diet versus an animal-based diet and the impacts on, again, world hunger and obesity.
It's a great question. So the trouble is it's impossible to take a regular plant-based diet and a regular animal-based diet because it depends how you do it. It's entirely possible, for example, to eat soy that is grown with soybeans that come from Brazil, from the Brazilian, the Brazilian Cerrado, where I did some of the research for Stuffed and Starved, where this rich ecosystem is being destroyed and leveled by farmers who are growing this crop, growing soybeans. And the impact of that is very carbon negative. Plus, they're involved in exploiting workers. Plus, they're pushing off farmers, small scale farmers, who are fighting for their land rights. Tofu, the sort of embodiment of what's meant to be a kind of groovy, low carbon diet, can actually be fairly pernicious. On the other hand, it's possible for meat that comes from pasture-raised agriculture to be a sustainable part of a low carbon agriculture system. If the meat is used if the animals before they become meat, they're animals, if those animals are used for traction and they're used on the farm and they're a source of fertilizer and they're a source of keeping a system closed and viable, then actually that can be have a very small environmental impact. That said, the way that most meat is produced today isn't that way. It involves both destruction of the Amazon. So most of the soy that we eat is first eaten by animals. If you eat raw soy, you will get nothing but flatulence, I discovered. That soy is eaten by animals, and then those animals are in confined or concentrated animal feeding operations, and they have huge environmental impacts. We have the dead zone the size of New Mexico, of New Jersey in the Gulf of Mexico, and that dead zone is growing and growing because of runoff from these concentrated animal feeding operations. So, I think other things being equal, obviously, when we rear animals and treat animals this way, eating an animal-based diet is going to be far more deleterious to the environment, detrimental to the environment than a plant-based diet. But it does depend on how you do it, and that's why it's so important to know your farmer and know that farming system rather than trusted label.
It is amazing to see high-level members of the UN talk about the benefits of eating a plant-based diet and how it affects the environment.
No, I do think that's that shift is something that we all need to be bearing in mind. I think in the future, and I'm agreeing here with everyone, from Michael Pollan, Mark Pittman, there are a range of people who say, look, we need to be eating less meat, and that's okay, particularly given that what passes for meat these days really isn't very good. And so eating less and enjoying it more, I think, is definitely a way to go if meat's your thing.
Thank you.
Hi there. I was wondering how much access you have or influence you would have on the policymakers associated with the Farm Bill in terms of encouraging them to maybe shunt dollars to better programs, like, say, more of a focus on small vegetable farmers.
I have painfully little access to anyone, I think it's a great question, because now's a really good time for us to realize how politics works in this country, because it's not in anyone's gift to be able to make these amendments happen so much as it is our duty as citizens to make sure that the Farm Bill doesn't is a source for a sustainable food system, and if you go to yourcallradio, I believe, .org,
right.
You will find transcripts from and links from today's show where we were talking about the Farm Bill, where there's a range of organizations that are doing that have amazing amendments that are important to put into this Farm Bill that everyone needs to be able to support and sign up for. So I absolutely recommend going right there.
Yeah, it's incredible how it affects everything from hemp to food stamps, to subsidies. I mentioned today that David Bronner, the CEO of Dr. Bronner's, was arrested in front of the White House last night because he put himself in a cage with 12 hemp plants. And they arrested him for possibly distributing marijuana, and he spent the night in jail.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah, exactly. So there is an amendment in the Farm Bill that would allow for farmers to grow hemp.
Right.
So thank you for the question.
Again, I'd like to thank you for your great presentation. One of the things that I'm very concerned about, and you had brought this up when you went to Costa Rica, about the advent of more fast food places, and you had mentioned how India now is having a high rate of type 2. It's bad enough that we're genetically predisposed to it, but what is worsening the situation is this new wealth that's coming, especially to the younger folks. And almost every night when I've traveled to India, I see people in fast food places eating late at night. How could one reverse that kind of a trend?
That's a very deep question. I mean, I think, in part, of course, the way that we come to understand our food system is through advertising. The way we become sort of habituated to thinking that this is a good thing to do is through through advertising. And I'm with the American Psychological Association in thinking that advertising to kids under the age of 8 is a bad idea, and I don't think we should, because kids under the age of 8 are not in a position to make rational choices, because they can't tell the difference between advertising and lies. And yet, when we're surrounding our kids with these kinds of adverts and these kinds of models of eating, it's not surprising that they grow up with bad food habits. But that's not the only reason why fast food is important. It's also about the pace of our lives. When we're running from one job to another, when we're not able to take the time to eat, when we're dashing, but when we're on the sort of consumption treadmill, working in order to be able to have the various trinkets that make our world, that make corporations money, we find that we have much less time to eat and to enjoy and to savor this food. And I think that that's why what we absolutely need to be doing is thinking about raising wages, or actually rethinking the way that we work in society, to think about a living wage for everyone, to make sure that we have the time to cook and the time to eat and the time to share. But that's something that requires a much deeper examination of the way our society works. It means addressing everything from healthcare to pensions to education to housing. But I think dreaming big is what we can and should do. I mean, addressing, because these problems are big problems. And no one should think that we're going to solve them by shopping better at a farmer's market. And we absolutely need to be thinking about these bigger picture issues, but that's empowering, right? To actually be able to think, actually, the world I want to live in doesn't look like this one, and it's okay. I think that that's a very empowering place to be.
Thank you for the question. And unfortunately, we're almost out of time. Here at Inforum, we like to end all of our events by asking our speakers the following question. Raj, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
There's a group that follows on right on from the last question. There's a group in Detroit called Cook, Eat, Talk. And what they do is they cook, and then they eat, and then they talk. And they bring together people from the neighborhood, and they cook meals together, and they discuss what's wrong with the food system and what's wrong with the neighborhood, and then dream it better. And I think generating the community and generating the dreams, we fight back in some very important ways. We stop the individualization of our consumption, but we also allow ourselves to become political animals and social animals by dreaming of a better world. And we'd never give ourselves permission to do that. And having a space where we can dream of a better world is the first step to making it.
Yes, thank you. Let's give a big round of applause to Raj Patel for sharing his thoughts with us tonight. Thank you. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.